Welcome to the Poly Museum of the History of the Polish Jews. My name is Hanna Węgrzynek. I'm a member of research department of the museum. And I have a great pleasure to introduce you, our guest, Professor Dan Miron, an expert in Yiddish and Hebrew literature, and his professional and also author of several works devoted to these topics. And in his professional life, Professor Dan Miron has been connected with Hebrew University in Jerusalem and with Columbia University in New York. Professor Dan Miron is going to speak today about Sholem Aleichem, one of the fathers of Yiddish literature, the best known as an author of, as the author of stories about David Milkman, popularizing in the film The Fiddler on the Roof. And Sholem Aleichem was born in Pereyaslav in 1859, died in 1916 in New York, and today's lecture marks the 100th anniversary of his death. Professor Dan Miron is going to speak today about unique language of Sholem Aleichem, full of colloquial expression, describing everyday life in Jewish shtetls in the best way. Professor Miron, welcome.
Many thanks. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming. And let me start. Sholem Aleichem burst. He was a bomb of energy and talent on the scene of Jewish writing, Yiddish writing, which was very, very much at the beginning of coalescing into something which only in the 80s of the 19th century was called Yiddish literature. At that time, in the early 1880s, starting in 1883, and within that decade, the 80s of the 19th century, he became the most popular Yiddish writer of the day. Essentially, he became the writer, the Yiddish writer of a new era, a new epoch, which started in the 1880s and went on up to the beginning of World War I, maybe a few years before then. And the question that I want to put to you is, in what way was he essential? In what way he represented what was going on in Jewish life and in Yiddish literature at the time? The answer is not as simple as it seems or as it's often being given. If you ask the 100th century of criticism and of talking about Sholem Aleichem, you can reduce the answer to three words: humor, shtetl, panorama, something like a wide view, which mean together that this was a writer who, in his many, many works, the 28 volumes of his standard edition include only about half of his output, offered a social historical panorama of traditional Jewish life in Eastern Europe, bathed in empathic humor. That's more or less the answer. Of course, the answer can be enlarged on and developed, but the basis is this, and what it means is that Sholem Aleichem's contribution was essentially mimetic, descriptive. He described a world that was undergoing change and really filled it with types like Tevye, like Menachem Mendel, like Shimon Elish Makoleinu, like so many others, and offered a view or a picture which was softened compared to the satirical view of Jewish traditional life in the 19th century. That is, he moved from satire to humor. Now, this answer, which of course has something true about it, as most cliches do, raises more questions that we have to ponder. For one thing, if the achievement of Sholem Aleichem was descriptive, mimetic, what he described, then something strange is true about Sholem Aleichem. The 80s and the 90s, this is the years that really made him the writer he was, were a new development in European life, in Russian life, in Eastern European life, but mostly in Jewish life. And what really decided the basic features of these years, as far as the Jews were concerned, were pogroms, popularization, and immigration. Pogroms, of course, all of these existed before the 80s. There was a famous pogrom in Odessa in 1870. But the pogroms of 1881 and 1882, triggered by the assassination of Alexander II, really changed the scene of Jewish life, pervading it with a new sense of discomfort, fear, and acknowledging the fact that the future of Jews in Eastern Europe in general, and particularly within the Tsarist Empire, was dim. It was not only the pogroms themselves and the havoc that they wreaked, the destruction. It was that compared to what happened in the 20th century is just mere nothing. It was the consequences of the pogrom. The pogrom started in a Jewish vagrancy that is not often talked about in other terms than immigration, but there was other sides to it. For instance, the writers of the time paid attention to the Jewish white flesh market that flourished in the 80s and the 90s. This was written about by Spector, by writers of the time, by Abramovich Mendele in his great novel, Das Schwindschwingel, and so on and so forth. So these were consequences of this array of kind of havoc in Jewish life. Many people left their place. Not all of them arrived in America or in the West. Some of them lost way. And the Jewish world, which was static until then, more or less, it had its own developments, really was a new world, with vagrancy, with movement, with a kind of an irresolute mobility. Now, popularization, of course, also started much earlier. But it achieved in the 80s and the 90s a new level of poverty, of penury. It's not true that the picture of the Jewish shtetl is a very poor place that we have, for instance, in the writings of Mendele, of Abramovich, Kaptziel, Kaptzansk, Tuniadivke, is historically true for the beginning of, let's say, of the 19th century or the end of the 18th century. It was the downfall of feudal order with the inroads of capitalism in Eastern Europe that sort of left the shtetl as an economic unit high and dry, without its function as the negotiator between the village around it, the peasants, and the nearest source of commercial goods. So pauperization was very, very advanced in the 80s, and both the pogroms and the pauperization led to emigration, to huge emigration, which we know as the emigration which established the Jewish Eastern European presence out of Eastern Europe, in America, in England, in so many other places. Now, interestingly, you look at Sholem Aleichem's mimetic or descriptive career throughout the first 20 years of his, or 15 years of his writing. You wouldn't know about all this. He never tells you about it. Neither the pogroms, nor the terrible poverty, and all the other things that I was talking about. He was telling you about middle-class love, inside wedding, outside of the wedding, the de-stabilizing and inspiring influence of art, of music, other things, but he never told about the pogrom before 1907 in his famous novel, pogrom novel, The Marble, The Deluge, which he wrote after he witnessed a pogrom in Kiev in 1905. About poor people, you just should compare him to Peretz. When Peretz started writing Yiddish stories in the early 1890s, he immediately delved into the issue of total poverty of the shtetl in his series, The Provinzreise, scenes from exploring the provinces, the Polish provinces around Warsaw at the time. And immediately he then went on to write about poverty and friction within the shtetl between classes. And therefore, he was embraced by socialists. And he became their writer, the writer of the Bund, in spite of the fact that he was not a member of the Bund himself. He really steeped himself into the issue of life in penury, in poverty. Sholem Aleichem didn't do that. He was the writer of the middle class. All his characters, until 1900, more or less, are middle-class people, even Menachem Mendel. About the pogrom, interestingly, in one of his earliest feuilletons, it's written by a reporter. It's never mind. This is, this reporter is a dead person, and he corresponds from the other world with somebody who lost his sanity in this world. He says, "I came to Balta. Balta is a Ukrainian town where a terrible pogrom took place in the early 1880s." And he says, "But I wouldn't stay there for a minute because I was afraid by the memory. The memory of the pogrom really sent me on my way." And he doesn't dedicate more than two lines to the pogrom in Balta. He doesn't tell about it. Whereas all the other important writers of the day write about pogroms at length. Intellectually, now, we are not talking about social tides like emigration or things like that. The 80s and the 90s were the time of the Great Awakening. Once the ideas that somehow and Jewish Enlightenment is going to bring to the Jews or give the Jews what they called emancipation, that is the right of a citizen, this was kind of for a dream that was proved wrong. Then this is the time for Zionism, of Jewish socialism, and all the other movements that were triggered by the sense that Jewish life cannot continue the way it was dealt with traditionally in the shtetl atmosphere, and new things have to happen in life. Sholem Aleichem was a committed Zionist. I think he was the one great Yiddish writer who was a committed Zionist, even a delegate to Zionist congresses. But he didn't write about Zionism. He wrote a very slim and unimportant novel in the 90s, which is called Mashiach Zeiten, but there's very little about it, and very little intellectual investment in it. Whereas, for instance, Abramovich has this story, this wonderful story about a person of the shtetl, Moichas Sforim, who decided to go and to become a farmer in Palestine. And the comedy starts there, and you can think about what happens and how this person comes to understand that this is not for him. Of course, socialism he doesn't write about. Not at that time. Everything starts late, particularly in the last decade of his life, after 1905. Then he writes the great emigration novel, Blanche de Stern, the theater novel, or the famous story about Mortal Pacey dem Chazans, which is a story about emigration. Then he writes about poor people. Then he writes about, even he has a wonderful story about a person. Somebody meets in a train compartment, and it turns out that he's a owner of a big brothel or brothel system, a Jew from Courland in the Argentine. Things like that appear then, but not at the beginning. So in what way he was the essential writer of the time? Now, the answer is that not in description, not mimetically. This was not his forte. And in spite of, the critics said otherwise for a hundred years. But the best first seminal article on Shalom Aleichem, which was written by the great Hebrew writer Yosef Chaim Brenner, who was assassinated near Jaffa in 1921. He wrote, when he's describing things, people, developments, Shalom Aleichem is just another writer. He's not in any way the great writer that he is. When does he become the great writer? That's what Brenner says. He becomes the great writer when he is a supreme stenographer of the people. That is, a stenographer. He sits there and writes, and the people talk, and he sits and writes. And you ask yourself, how can that be? It cannot be. He's a writer who sits at his desk and writes novels and stories. He is not a stenographer. Also, Yiddish linguists, some of them of great acumen, particularly one Soviet Yiddish linguist by the name of Elias Pivek, checked carefully the language Shalom Aleichem used and came up with the idea that none of it was really spoken Yiddish. None whatsoever. Every structure was processed. It was based on spoken Yiddish, but it was not spoken Yiddish. Nobody talked like that. He just managed to create the illusion that people talk this way. But that's not true. When you checked it linguistically with sharp linguistic tools and analyzed the writing, you saw that that was not it. So he was not a stenographer in any sense. A stenographer just writes what he's being told. So what is it? I say it's essentially an essence. His great achievement is in tonality, not in the descriptive mimetic contents of what he is. It's the music. Shalom Aleichem is like when you go in the street and a car passes by and the window is open and you hear a piece of Chopin or Beethoven, no matter which one. You immediately know, this is Chopin, this is Beethoven. No music sounds like that. Even if what you caught in your ear is a snippet of it. The same is Shalom Aleichem. when you take a page, even a torn page from a newspaper, you don't know what's the beginning and the end. You can say, aha, this is Shalom Aleichem. So what you know is not the contents. What you know is the music. It's the tone. And what is this tone? This is the big question. Not how Menachem Mendel is a Luftmensch or Tevye is the traditional Jew with Bitochen. Those, all of those things are problematic. They are actually not right, particularly about Tevye. Tevye is an obsessive speaker. He is a person who must talk, must, because his life is horrible. And he, in a way, is responsible for his failures. He's responsible for the fact that one daughter committed suicide, the other daughter married a non-Jew, with him doing nothing but talking about midrashim and making stories, and he must talk. He's a Scheherazade. He lives from one meeting with Shalom Aleichem to another to push out of himself an experience that otherwise would have destroyed him the way it destroyed his wife. We have a wonderful description of his wife dying on him. And she says, Tevye, there's a midrash about that and there's a midrash about that, and I'll tell you what the sages say. Tevye, I'm dying. Who is going to cook dinner for you? That there's an, also a medrash about that, if you want. There is a story about a chacham. Tevye fends off reality, fends off his life goal there, fends off everything by talking. So it's the talking, it's the huge, the wonderful energy, the elixir of talking, of language, that is there, that is Shalom Aleichem. The tonality of Shalom Aleichem is what he is. And that's why he became the great writer of his time. In that, he is very similar to the other major writer, Jewish writer of the same time, which is the poet Chaim Nachman Bialik. And they both knew each other and greatly appreciated each other. What Bialik's achievement was not the contents of the poems, not the Zionist ideas. He was a Zionist, of course. Not the story about tradition fighting off modernity in the figure of the scholarly, the Talmudic scholar. It's a new music which incorporated the consciousness of the new Jewish subject. It's the subjectivity of who speaks in the poem, who uses the language. It's also tonality rather than the ideas. The ideas were shared by hundreds of others, and you can find expressions of them here, there, and anywhere else if you know the corpus. The same is true about Shalom Aleichem. The story about Chava, for instance, the famous story about of which the Tevye drama written by Shalom Aleichem himself and then Fiddler on the Roof was based. How the daughter, his daughter, the beautiful daughter Chava, that's what, why she's called Chava, that is, she's femininity. She's what women or woman is about, supposedly. She marries a non-Jew. And you know the story from Fiddler and from others. It's a plagiat. It's a plagiat. It's not a story. It's based on another story of an American Jewish writer who tells exactly the same story. Not the same names, but the daughter of a simple Jew leaves a house, and how the father reacts and the mother and what's going on between them. But it's drab compared to Shalom Aleichem. It's dead compared to the story, to the chapter in Chava, because there what you have is this electricity of the telling that is making the story a story. It's not the sheer contents. Now, what's really the tonality about is, first of all, mobility. Quirky, staccato mobility. And that's how you can know Shalom Aleichem when you see a piece of newspaper. It's the same, it's the staccato. It's the music of ta-ta-ta, 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 quick, 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 that you catch. To start with, it has to do, and the mobility is both geographical and linguistic and psychological. It starts with Shalom Aleichem himself. What is Shalom Aleichem? What does that name mean? It was compared to the name, to the pen name Mendele Moichas Forim, Mendele the Book Peddler, but it's a false comparison. Mendele the Book Peddler is a real person. The name is a real name. The profession of book peddling, of selling books, was a profession. He has a wife. We know where he was born. He has a biography. He has a personality. None of this exists in Shalom Aleichem. You don't know where he comes from. You don't know where he was born. There is no life story behind the Shalom Aleichem persona. Who is he? He's mystical. He's always somewhere else. He appears, usually by train. We'll talk about the importance of train. But not only by train. He suddenly appears in Masbevke, or later on in Kasrilivke. By the way, Kasrilivke, the mythological shtetl, was invented in the 20th century. It was not part of the early writing of Shalom Aleichem. He appears helter-skelter, very, very quickly, coming from somewhere. And people say, Shalom Aleichem, which means, hello, how do you do? That's the meaning of the name. It's a play, because Shalom sounds like a real name, which was his real name, Shalom Rabinovich. But when you put to it the Aleichem, which is from the liturgy, it's what you say to the angels on Friday evening, when you shir Shalom Aleichem, Malachei HaShalom, Malachei HaSharet, and so on and so forth. It's a game. It's mystification. And, you know, in many of the stories, Shalom Aleichem appears and is asked by people, where did you come from? And what he says is, Mishut ba'aretz umit halech ba, which means from going to and fro in the land and roaming in it. I'm not, of course, this, you know, who answers this question? What question is this? This is the question of God when Satan appears suddenly, a bit late, to the gathering of the angels in the first chapter of Job, and God asks him, Me'ayin bata, where do you come from? And Satan says, Mishut ba'aretz umit halech ba, I just roam the land. It's a satanic answer. And Shalom Aleichem loved the satanic element in it, because the Shalom Aleichem figure, the persona, was a letz. Now, if you know, in modern Yiddish and in modern Hebrew, letz means a joker. But in the Jewish deep roots of the name, a letz is a minor devil. A letz belongs, it's not the high echelon of the servants of the devil, but it's somebody who do pranks, who you should be wary of. Don't be too friendly with him, because, and now how he calls himself, what am I? A verschleppte Krank. You know what's that? It's a protracted sickness. Somebody who may do you harm in a funny way. And indeed, you know, the early feuilleton of Shalom Aleichem's, people write to him, do harm to that and that person, I hate him. Write about him. Expose him if you can. And of course you can. You have the newspaper at your disposal. Why don't you tear this person apart? He's a mystical figure. A nice, a funny, jovial figure that you say Shalom Aleichem to. Then you know, when do you say Shalom Aleichem as when you meet somebody? You don't say it to a person you saw yesterday or who lives near the, in the other street. You say it to a foreigner or to somebody who for a long time you didn't see. Aha, you deserve a big Shalom Aleichem. That's a part of the ritual. And you know, people in Shalom Aleichem's writing ask him, what's your name? And he says, Shalom Aleichem. They say, Aleichem HaShalom. They understand it as a part of a ritual answer. But what's your name? All this goes to show that he's not from here. He's not from you don't know where he is. He moves all the time. He's erratic. You find it here, you find it there. In the early feuilletons, he soars in the air. He comes in balloons, like Jules Verne's. And his movement. Also, he does something about him that is unknown. And when you go from Shalom Aleichem to his main characters, what you find is rhythm. They can be very, very different from each other. You read the first story of Tevye. I don't want to quote it at length because this is not the opportunity. Tevye has just now saved two women who were lost in the forest. And it turns out that they are of the richest family in the neighborhood. So he brings them home. And, of course, it's the house of a gavir, of a very rich person. And everybody welcomes them, and there's a table laden with all good things. And suddenly the gavir turns to him and asks him, and who are you, Tevye? Tevye starts a rigmarole that is something that a good actor needs to do. Forget about Fiddler on the Roof. It's all in verse. And it's all made of clichés, of little clichés. Ich hab sieben Töchter, and when you have sieben Töchter, the Gelächter, then you don't smile anymore because seven daughters is something to contend with. It's a big burden. And so on. He plays quickly with words, and then he starts with his midrashim. And you know, in the Tevye story, nobody wants to listen to Tevye. His wife says, "Enough! We know that you are learned. We don't want you to talk about it." He deals with women because he sells dairy product. He always goes to the kitchen. And he said, and when they say to him something, he starts telling them about the Talmud says half of what he quotes from the Talmud is invented. There was never written in the Talmud, and the other half is full of mistakes. And when he translates from Hebrew, the translation is hilarious. It's so wrong, and so grotesquely wrong. And the women said, "But stop talking. All I care about is that the butter is fresh," says one of them. "No, there's a midrash on that too." And it goes on and on and on. There's something absolutely obsessive about it. And there's absolutely obsessive about other things. For instance, how Menachem Mendel starts a letter, his first letter. Menachem Mendel is a young man of the lower middle class who got a dowry of the fixed dowry of a lower middle class bridegroom, which was 1,500 rubles. That was the sum. And of course, as long as he lived with his in-laws, and in the meantime also had three or four children, he didn't use the money. The money was given to a rich uncle in Romania to do business with it, and probably the money will grow. Now he has to leave the house of his in-laws, and he cannot really live there because of his mother-in-law, whom he cannot abide anymore. And he goes to collect his dowry. But the uncle doesn't want to give him his dowry and probably doesn't have the money to give him his dowry. So a story starts, and he gets 200 or 300 rubles and stops in Odessa. He doesn't go home. And then he goes out in the street in Odessa, and he's completely, completely enthusiastic. He says, "Habe ich 20,000 Geschäftler. Will ich weiß, ist weiß. Klein ist klein. Wohl ist wohl. Mehl, Salz, Federn, Roginkes, Zeck, Hering, Haklal, was a moil con oisren. I have 20,000 businesses if I want. I fancy wheat, there's wheat. Brands, there's brands. Wool, there's wool. Flour, salt, feathers, raisin, sacks, herring. In short, everything a mouth can pronounce. But of course, he will buy none of this. These are too real. He will buy stocks on the stock exchange. That's what really drives him. And you can feel the kind of the tone of his letter writing. But among others, this is a tone of a person who does not communicate at all. He's so full of himself, he's so bubbling, that he doesn't answer the questions his wife asks. He doesn't relate to her concerns. She tells him about the children and how sick they were, and she's sick, and this and that. Nothing. He doesn't even bother to think about it. What he talks about is the new business, is what he sees, and the tone is there all the time. Or Motel. Motel is a little boy of, we don't know exactly, 5, 6, 7, probably somewhere in between, who loves to forget. The past is horrible. The past is a dying father, decrepit, stinking. He cannot really abide the past. The past is a psychotic old man who is a scholar of Rambam. And the boy is being hired, the family is poor, to be with him in the night. And then this scholarly person tells him why, by sheer logic, he has to eat him alive. Now, so what he wants is every moment, the life of every moment, ich läuf. He's going to the marketplace where they sell horses. And the Loschiklech, the young horses, run around and says, "Ich läuf noch die Loschiklech. Alle läufen mir. Auf läufen bin ich afeier. Ich hab sehr geringe Fies. Dazu gehe ich bei Borwissen sehr leicht angetan. Ein Händel, ein Häus und von oben ein Sitzen, aber kann fies. Als ich läuf a Rob, a Berg, und sie ist ein Windel und die Zitzes zerlassen sich, muss ich mir aus, als ich hab Fliegel und ich flieh." Translation: I run after the colts. All of us run. In running, I'm a champion. I have very light legs. On top of that, I'm barefoot and very lightly dressed. A little shirt, one trouser leg, covered by a cotton mini garment with tassels. When I run downhill and there is a light wind, and the tassels swing in the air, it seems to me that I have wings and I fly." And his entire experience of emigrating, with horrible suffering around him, people lose everything they have. His mother has two big red eyes, and she's the past. The past is tears. The past is tragedy. And because of this past, they won't be able to come to America because the eyes are not what they should be. This is beside him. This is not what he wants. He wants this sense of going from place to place to place to place, from adventure to adventure, from one thing to another. And you have this kind of frequency, this kind of music that is Shalom Aleichem, which is movement, movement, movement. You know, Romain Rolland, once a very famous French writer, I think he was sort of demoted. I think he was very popular in Poland too. Jean Christophe and so on. When he gave permission to translate his Collaboration into Hebrew, he wrote a new introduction to the book. And he says, what I see in front of me is my Kola meeting with Tevye in Palestine. And what they do for the rest of their life is bavardage, is loquation, is talking, the two great talkers. And he was the first who put his finger on that, that what we have in Tevye was not only the story about the daughters representing new love, a free love, or socialism. That's part of it. What we have is bavardage. We have this speech, that goes on and probably is really feeling some existential need, with words creating a cocoon around the personality, and it's the best mechanism of self-defense. This cloud of words. Now, this verbal velocity, which is what is the music of Shalom Aleichem? It's not important if it's a symphony or it's an etude. It's the music that's there. Is Shalom Aleichem's response from a very, very deep artistic sense to the new Jewish condition. Because what was this condition? It was a condition of long stability. Life that really went on with changes, of course. We know what we know about the 18th century, the 19th century. There were huge changes. But still, life has a form, the shtetl. And suddenly, the floor fell from underneath the feet. And what Jews started to do is this. Urbanization, emigration, and so on and so forth. You know, there's a feuilleton in which Shalom Aleichem is being asked, where have you been? We were looking for you. Well, you have been in Carlsbad. You've been in Leipzig. Where have you been? And here is his answer. Gewein bin ich zwischen euch. Mit euch, neben euch, die ganze Zeit, zusammen mit euch, bin ich gewein navenad. Translation. I was among you, with you, near you all the time. Together with you, I have been navenad. Now, navenad, two Hebrew words, which, of course, are the words from the story of Cain. Because when Cain murdered his brother and had to leave, God made him leave his field because Cain was a farmer, and what he knew how to do is to grow vegetables and maybe wheat. And now he has to go and never be in one place. He would be navenad, moving and roaming. And the use of this word, like mishut ba'aretz u'mi'italech ba, or like lech lecha me'artzecha, which is the title of the last story of Tevye, that's what God says to Abraham, you go, get thee gone out of your country and of your home, of your father's home, and go to where I show you. I won't even tell you now where. Just go. This is the root, the cultural root of the Shalom Aleichem symphony. It's mythical, and it means that the basic myth is the one of movement. It can be a movement of different kinds, because Lech Lecha, get thee gone, is pointing to Palestine. You go and I'll show you the country where to go. Navenad is nowhere. It's just in you go, you have no karka, no land but underneath your feet, and you have to go. You have to move, which is what Tevye is being told in the last story. Don't stay in your village. Just go. And he says to Shlomo Aleichem, and he meets him, I just go. When God tells me to go, I go. And where we will meet next, maybe in Kiev, maybe in Warsaw, maybe in New York, maybe in, and all Jews go all over the place, and I'll go with them. Here's the nexus. I do it with you. I am with you, even when I'm not with you. Why am I so mobile? Because your modus of existence now is mobility. Jews. So it's not the folklore of the shtetl. Far from it. It's losing everything. It's leaving behind you everything because you have to move, because you have to go. It's therefore that the train compartment is so important to Shlomo Aleichem. And some of the best thing he writes is in the train. And the train is an anti-shtetl. Supposedly it's a shtetl. It's the same Jews sitting there and talking, but they don't know each other. You don't know really who is behind you, who is near you. Maybe he's a crook, and often he is. Maybe he'll steal your money. Maybe he wants to draw you into some game with money and leave you without anything. One of them is a robber who says that it's a kosher work to rob, for instance, diamonds. But it's not kosher for him to find something that somebody lost and not give it back. That's different. You don't know who they are, these Jews. This is not a shtetl. But what do they have in common? Yiddish. That's what they have in common. They can talk. Talk all the time. And that's what happens in these train compartments. And in talking, they make funny mistakes. Shlomo Aleichem loves misunderstandings. Just for instance, in Tevye. Tevye comes to the house of the butcher. And the butcher says, she's like that and she's like that and I want her. And he's sure that he's talking about his best cow. But what he talks about is his daughter. He wants to marry his daughter. He's now an alman, he's a widower, and he wants to marry his daughter. And it takes half of the story before we know what they are talking about. In another story, it happens in the train compartment, going through the Jewish Pale in the Ukraine, people listen to what two people say, and they hear the words, genumen, aha. The sons were accepted to the gymnasium, which every Jew wants for his child. And it's so difficult to get into a Russian gymnasium. But finally it turns out that they were Zugenommen, they were taken to the army and drafted, and so on and so forth. He makes wonderful use of Yiddish being the common denominator, but yet being off a little bit, being a kind of a mistake. So he's among his Jews, and he reproduces the music of the existence, the tempo of the existence, not necessarily the stories. These are secondary. And when he does that, he creates something which is essentially funny, and we are going to talk about it. Why is it funny? In what sense is it really funny? It's not because it's not a satire. Forget about it. Much of what Shlomo Aleichem wrote is very satirical, bitingly so. Not less than Mendeley, than Abramovich. But there's something there which corresponds to the new times, but not only to the new times. To something which is quintessentially, or which is understood as quintessentially Jewish. You know, there's a story that Shlomo Aleichem wrote about a group of Jews from Kastrelivke who goes to Kiev. The group goes to Kiev. And why do they go to Kiev? Headed by Rabbi Yosef, by the naive Rav, the rabbi of the place. Because the Beis Medrash, the synagogue, was burnt down. And they don't have money to rebuild it, so they have to go to the big city and find good Jews who will give them money. By the way, scenes of conflagration, of, you know, the Sreifes, that are being strewn all over the place, all over Jewish literature of the time, always have a mythical basis, which is the Churban, which is the destruction of God's temple in Jerusalem. You know, Bialik, who wrote the great poem about the destruction of the temple, Megillat HaEsh, the Scroll of Fire, said in an evening that where his poem was discussed, it's actually an enlargement of what I was awoken to as a child when the shtetl burnt. And it, to me as a child, it was the end of the world. And I immediately understood it in terms, in theological terms, as the destruction of the house of God by God himself. Now, so that these Jews, with their synagogue being burned down, go to Kiev. They look at the high houses, and they don't know, they are provincials, they don't know but how to walk there. But this is one thing they have to count on, and that's the parasols. This all shtetl Jews, when they leave their home, equip themselves with strangely oversized parasols, very big, supposedly meant to serve as protection from rain, but also as a sun, as a sunshade. However, they hardly ever opened these gadgets, whether it rained or the sun was glaring. Indeed, it was quite difficult to unfold these huge things. And if it happened that the coiled spring was unintentionally touched and activated, and the umbrellas or the parasols would open up and stretch to their full capacity, then it would be impossible to refold them and bring back the gadgets to their original state. So rather, the umbrellas would now become parachutes, which could soar when driven by the wind. It can, God forbid, raise you in the air and carry you away far from under the cloud, almost like airplanes. That's Sholem Aleichem at the beginning of the century. And it's one of the greatest symbols. So the Jews are like a parasol. Nobody opens it. It's an old parasol, big one. But the possibility, the potential for something to click, and then it opens, and then you cannot close it anymore, and then it moves with the wind. That's what happened in Jewish life in the end of the 19th century. Exactly. And Jews started to move with the parasols to America, to England, to South America, and they wouldn't stop it. But there's something quintessentially Jewish about it. Now we can start to look into some topics at the very end of this presentation. Let's go back to the issue of Sholem Aleichem as a descriptive writer. He was not. You compare him to Mendeley, and it simply doesn't compare. Abramovich had this epic tone. He can describe a landscape very meticulously. It comes alive. You see the details. He enters a bathhouse full of naked goyim, and you can see the goyim and their nakedness and everything there through the fog of the bathhouse. Sholem Aleichem never does that. And if he tries to, it's unsuccessful. You don't have this kind of pictorial memories of what he sees. That's not what you remember him for. two things are not important to him. Both space and time. Space, of course, there's space. People live and move and so on and so forth. But the description of space is not interesting. When mortal goes from one European city to the other, he never sees the city. Vienna, Lemberg, Hamburg, London, you don't see them. What you see is the adventures, it's the other person facing him, it's what Pigne did and what his brother Elia did, and so on and so forth. You know, Zionists thought that the loss of the sense of space was the great sin. What Jews had to reconquer, what Jews had to readjust to, is space. There's even a brand of Zionism which is all directed in space, and it's called cosmic Zionism. The father of cosmic Zionism is the philosopher, a great and interesting one, Adé Gordon, who says what happened to the Jews is that they lost the sense of touch with what's around them, with the elements. And this sense of touch cannot be gained by looking at things. It has to be gained through your hand. If you start to do something in the field, then the field becomes real. Until you do that, it's unreal. And what he meant is that only physical labor will bring the Jew back to the cosmos, to the elements. Sholem Aleichem was in this sense an exilic Jew, a Goles Yid. He never really tried to touch things in this way. Maybe houses, some utensils, his penknife in the famous story, but not the landscape around, not the field, not the forest, not the river, never. What does he have instead of space? Language. The real space is linguistic. It's not natural, and it's not the space of objects. But time. Time in Sholem Aleichem. Sholem Aleichem is not really interested in history and never writes a historical story. Or that maybe that there's an attempt once in a while, but you don't remember it. It's not important. Also, as a lover of Yiddish, and we'll talk about that, we'll end with this, he was not interested in etymology and in the history of the language. He was interested in the language in really Chomskyan terms, as generative grammar, as something that is imbued, that it's part of you, and you can create communication through it, not as something that leads you to the past. That's why he could never write well Hebrew. Hebrew was a language, not that he didn't try. He tried, but he completely failed. And it's not because he didn't have talent like all the other maskilim who knew Hebrew. He knew Hebrew. It's because his attachment to language has nothing to do with the past, has nothing to do with history. It's totally focused on current communication, on talking, and talking quickly. In his stories, for instance, in Motel, which in many ways is the quintessential work, people ask themselves, why didn't he write the Motel story as a novel? It's a long book. It's unfinished. It was stopped in the middle of the second part. But it's a novel-sized story, and it has a plot because a family loses. First the father dies, then they lose everything they have, then they have to leave the shtetl, And then they roam through Europe until they get to London. From London, they cross the ocean, and they come to New York, and so on and so forth. But the stories I written are written, all of them, in present tense. And what the narrator knows in one story doesn't include what will happen in the next story. He knows what happened 2 weeks before the story is told, and not more than that. And critics and historians of literature came with ideas that that was done because it was meant for publication in newspapers, and the newspaper didn't want to publish. That's not true. Sholem Aleichem published novels in large sequels for years in the last decade of his career. It was because this is really what Motel is. He's the present. He's never the past nor the future. He's what happens now, at this point, and what can be reported hurriedly in as I said, staccato sentences from about what happened now. What's the last adventure? Or how funny was the mother when she went to the cemetery to take leave of father's grave before they left. The family left for America. She was absolutely funny, and when she embraced the Pesce, the neighbor, the description of the tears is like Vide Bob. It's like how would you translate it?
It's the same word in Polish.
Okay, and to him, it's exciting. It's something funny all the time. And that's the modus. That's the way he writes. In what sense he's the greatest humorist, Jewish humorist? As I said, it's not anything to do with not being satirical. And we know throughout the 20th century, the ideas about humor changed. Bergson told us that it's a punishment. That's the way society punishes whoever is not quick or not elastic enough to adapt itself to the élan vital that makes life possible. And Freud told us that it's a noble mechanism of self-defense, that you are a catexis. You put the large part of your libido in the superego so that the ego and its troubles suddenly seem shriveled, unimportant, and so on and so forth. Various theories. Really, with Sholem Aleichem, it has to do with the use of language. Sholem Aleichem is, humor is linguistic. But in the sense that language does not denotative, does not comes to tell you what really happens. It comes to protect you from what happens. In Sholem Aleichem, there's always a kind of a gap between the tragic reality, the tears of the mother, they're about to leave the Europe, Eastern Europe, where they... this is the world I know, and go who knows where, to New York. What is New York? It's tragic, but for the boy, it's funny, and he presents it in a language that is removed from the tragic part of it, and turns it into comedy through oxymora. Says, Ashrei, bin ich gut, ich bin a Yusim. How good to me, I am an orphan. And really, he goes on to tell you what's so wonderful about being an orphan. No father, no school, nobody's on your head. You don't have to do this and to do that, and nobody tells you around. You are free. You can do whatever you want, as long as there's food to eat. That's very important to model. Let me finish by saying by and large, Sholem Aleichem's humor draws its lifeblood from language, from the ebullient Yiddish on which the author forever embossed his signature. He believed Yiddish was inherently funny language, which by its very lexicon and syntax produced a comic view of reality. By this in itself, a legacy of the Jewish Enlightenment, because the Enlightenment despised Yiddish and saw it as funny, as grotesque. And its negative attitude towards Yiddish, he meant that for Yiddish speakers there existed an inherent contradiction between an essentially tragic historical life or fate and its comic linguistic counterpart, with the latter functioning as the antidote to the former. Yiddish consoled and mitigated, thus it did not offer a direct expression of Jewish existence, as sentimental Yiddishists maintain. On the contrary, it subverted such expression, transmuting groans of Oy vey veizmir into an upbeat and energetic flow of speech, which, as Kafka observed, you know, Kafka loved Yiddish. And he writes in his diary, I've been to Yiddish, to an evening with Yiddish folk songs. And look what, I'll read these lines for you. They're interesting. What I learned. Sorry. I lost it somewhere. It's possible. No, here it is. He says that, here's what Kafka says. Whereas in other languages, expressions with no contents, no semantic need, just feelings, intend to fill gaps in the continuity of the communication, actually conveyed the perplexity of the inarticulate speaker, these things that we put inside. In Yiddish, similar stop gaps, such as Weizmir, or Sisfil zu reden, he quotes in Yiddish, Germanizing the Yiddish in his diary, were used, I quote, like ever fresh springs to stir up the string of speech which was never fluent enough for the Eastern European Jewish temperament. That's Kafka. And as much as whatever Kafka says about Yiddish is problematic, this is Sholem Aleichem would have completely agreed with him. That's what Yiddish is about. Not oy vey or the vey of oy vey or vey ismir is tempo, is parts of the speech. It's not really something bad. The latter, Kafka, finding mobility and verbal energy, the means for somewhat counterbalancing an oppressive and limiting life experience. Does that mean that Yiddish, as Sholem Aleichem understood it, was also inherently optimistic, in spite of the tales of war it had to tell? Not necessarily. The comic and the optimistic should not be confused with each other. Indeed, the deeper we delve into the world of the comic, the more we realize how this world could be stripped of any faith in a bright future. As a matter of fact, it seems that a tragic world, when thoroughly understood, as for instance by following the entire cycle of the Oedipus dramas, including Oedipus in Colonus, the final link in the chain is where tragedy really becomes bright and harmonious. Sholem Aleichem, it can be demonstrated, did not possess that much confidence in the future of his people, in spite of his being a Zionist. He certainly did not view relocation of a sizable part of it to America as promising a Jewish renaissance. Palestine was still legendary and unreal. He did not even visit it, as so many other writers, celebrities of his day did. The point he made was that Jewish suffering could be counterbalanced by Jewish speech. That, at least as long as Yiddish was kept alive as a spoken language. what would happen once the language was forgotten? To this question, he had no answer. With Yiddish marking the edges, the very borderlines of his conceptual world, he would not turn his eyes to what lay in waiting beyond these lines. This deep loyalty of his to Yiddish and to the role it played as a spoken idiom of Eastern European Jews, as well as to his own artistic role as a central figure in a minor literature in the Deleuzian, I don't want to get into it since, is one of the main reasons for the persistence of his impact. Of all Yiddish writers, the one most deeply immersed in Yiddish, he is paradoxically also the one whose voice most clearly reaches us beyond the abyss of language loss, which is identical with the unspeakable loss of its speakers. Thank you.
Professor Miron, thank you for your fascinating lecture and for very new to me interpretation, very musical interpretation of Shalom Aleichem language. It's time for question and questions sure. and discussion. So, zapraszamy do pytań.
Thank you for this really fascinating lecture. And while hearing you saying that something common between Shalom Aleichem and Bialik, the tonality
yes.
and the subjectivity, and then you talked about motion, restless motion, language, moving, navanad.
Yes.
Do we have something like that in Hebrew literature?
Shuv lefanai zaken balet zashnave nadal gabe sfarim. Shuv lefanai zeskena bala orga pos orga pos ken orga sorga pos mekaot. That's Bialik. Bialik is full of linguistic motion. Kulam parchulayim, kulam nasa haruach, kulam parchulayim, shira chadasha et boker chayeh mirnina. You know this text, of course. Shulman, Bialik really, it's not the ideas. The ideas were common, there were the ideas of the time. It's a new voice of a subject. Li ein hela olam shebilvavi. I have nothing but the world inside me. And the world inside doesn't mean that you don't see what's in the outside. It means that you process it through a voice that it's intrinsic. That's why Bialik changed everything in Hebrew. There's Hebrew before Bialik and there's Hebrew after Bialik. And Bialik changed it because it turned it from a language of, which I'm not talking now about biblical Hebrew, which was pieces of quotations and references into a flowing music. Dumam now elas, dumam tasachu elai, boa ken, and so every line that you quote is moving. It's like you are on water, like you are going on a boat somewhere. And yes, Bialik created in the music of his poem the subjectivity of the new Jew, who was able to get away from texts, other texts, to get away from anything really which was fixed in a traditional culture and to become individual. Uncertain, always moving. Yeah, they are brothers in spirit. And you know why Shalom Aleichem never could become a bilingual writer? Never. In spite of the fact that he wanted it to the extent that when his son-in-law, Berkovich, started to translate his works into Hebrew, he didn't let him write his name. He cheated the public, assuming that this was his own translation. Bilingualism is like two elevators. When one goes up, one has to go down. And Shalom Aleichem never controlled this mechanism. because he was so completely into the movement of the Yiddish sentence, of Yiddish syntax. He couldn't be. When he tried to be bilingual, it was a failure, total failure. You can see it in the volume of Hebrew stories that was published by the late Shmeruk. If this was his legacy, we would have forgotten him long ago.
Well, my question will be completely of someone who is cut off from beauty and music, tonality, etc., etc., because of the lack of knowledge of Yiddish.
Uh-huh.
And my question is exactly connected with this handicap. If someone as me is, and I guess, for example, in Poland, most of us are cut off from Yiddish, could we, in translation, a little bit feel this staccato?
Paradoxically,
this
yes, we can. Even in a mediocre translation, it's very strange. When you read other great Yiddish writers in translation, it's like beyond a curtain. When you read Shalom Aleichem, you read Tevye in German, in French, in Polish, in Russian, it's very much alive. Because in Hebrew, because something of this linguistic dynamo really gets through. You feel it. It's there. Maybe you don't feel the entire impact of it. Of course not. But you do feel it. Shalom Aleichem never budged from Yiddish. Peretz wrote half of his work in Hebrew. Abramovich Mendeler wrote more than half of his work in Hebrew. They always dealt with the two possibilities. Hebrew, to bring down Hebrew into the more or less reality of the end of the 19th century, and to elevate Yiddish into literary effulgence. Shalom Aleichem couldn't do that. He wanted, but he couldn't. He was completely buried in Yiddish, exactly as Guattari and Deleuze say in the book about minor literature, you kind of borrow yourself you into the language, into the vernacular, into the provincial language. And that's how you achieve the wonderful impact that Kafka achieved. You know this book by Deleuze and Guattari about Kafka as an example of minor literature in the totally modern sense of the word. Shalom Aleichem is, you know, he was despised by Yiddishists for a long time. They didn't respect him at all. He was everything backward. He was the shtetl, they wanted the world. He was little people. Peretz said, you know why our literature is so dull about Abramovich and Shalom Aleichem? Because the people are dull. What they tell us is dull. It's a famous lecture. You should think about good things, about great things, about visionary things. Shabbos dike Yidden, mystical Jews. But you know who made the Yiddishists respect Shalom Aleichem? The Russian critics. When his work started to appear in a collection in Russian translation, and Gorky and Alexandrov said that this is a Jewish Dickens, they had somehow to come to terms with it. It's not a provincial writer they believed him to be. The only two people who really admired him before were Hebrew writers. Bialik, who quarreled with Peretz about him, and Berdyshevsky. They could see the genius. And Berdyshevsky said that what Shalom Aleichem did for Yiddish is what the Bible did for Hebrew. He said it. And in another place, he said what Shalom Aleichem did for Yiddish is what Rashi did for Hebrew. He totally understood it. Yes.
A
other questions? No, there's not questions.
Yes, I wonder if you could characterize the music of his writings. You mentioned that staccato, and you mentioned that it was different than spoken Yiddish. Could you give any other description about what the differences were? Were it short sentences, long sentences, strange vocabulary?
The difference, there's a whole book on the difference between his Yiddish and spoken Yiddish. And he's basing his Yiddish on spoken Yiddish, but he's not leaving it there. And what he usually does, the book gives us hundreds of examples. How the sentence would be spoken, let's say in Ukrainian Yiddish, and how he writes it, and how the syntax slightly is different. And what happened to the syntax is usually, not always, some contraction. It's a matter for scholarship. It's a matter for a scholarly description. You don't talk about linguistic matters without linguistic analysis. There's no sense in it. Whatever was said about Shalom Aleichem's style before Ilya Spivak said it in the late 30s in the Soviet Union was impressionistic and really unimportant because it was him, with him, that the matter was examined for the first time in details and with systematic linguistic behind it, Saussurean linguistic behind it. There's a book by Shalom Aleichem Sprach, The Language of Shalom Aleichem, written in the Soviet Union. By the way, the most serious part of the Shalom Aleichem criticism is Soviet. What the Soviets did in the 20s and the 30s, particularly Meir Wiener, Max Ehrlich, and the other great Soviet critics, all of them Marxists, and is what the tradition of Shalom Aleichem criticism really is made of.
So, yeah?
Opportunity. We have 100 years, so yeah. You probably have a look around the world. They are a river of publications, so how it is celebrated around the world.
Very much alive. He's been constantly retranslated into Hebrew. We had a classic translation by Berkovich, by his son-in-law, but this is a long time not used anymore, and we have new translations. I've done two translations or three translations myself, and others do it. It's been constantly retranslated into English. There are every few years there's a new translation of one of the works. I believe that in other languages, this happens often in German, I know, in Danish, a new version of... It's Norse, of course. It's the language spoken in both Denmark and Norway. Of Tevye appeared. Here sits Jacobi Weisse, who translated the comedy, which we call the Oitzer. The Oitzer, it's not the original title. The original title was Goldgräber. He translated it into English. And I don't know about the situation in Poland, but I would think that there are new Polish translations, aren't there? None? No?
I don't. So Michal Friedman, after Michal Friedman, who?
No.
I don't think so.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Hebrew is the language between us. Yes.
Why should we, you know? Why should we pretend to be what we are not? Anyway, maybe it's not an answer to your question, but in the Jewish theater, I had to receive a delegation of 12 professors from China because he's very popular in China, and. the capo, the tutti capi, the big shot who was at the head of the whole thing, said that the reason he's so popular in China is, according to them, there's no author in the whole world who delves so beautifully into the mind of a child.
Okay. You know, when I translated or retranslated, it has been translated several times, Stevia into Hebrew, but that was about a few years ago. Said Kashua, who is an Arab writer, said, now I can come in touch with Jewish literature. Yeah, it's so close to our villages.
Do people quote in normal life his books? Do people use the quotation of his books in normal life?
Who uses the quotation? I didn't get the question.
Whether he's quoted, you know,
like Shakespeare, right?
He was very much quoted as long as there was this community of Yiddish speakers. Everybody knew Rabin Glickler, Rabin Yusim. Everybody knew that. And many other kind of quips. But here we talk about a writer who was completely immersed in a language, the speakers of which disappeared. He wrote to Eastern European Jews living in here and in America and speaking the language that was his lifeblood. And the fact that he can exist beyond that as a writer, more than any other Jewish writer, perhaps with the exception of Singer, of Bashevis, is very telling. The one who really stayed, who really can talk to our time, is not Peretz and not Bergelson. We translate them. They are great writers. They have a very small group of people who can relate to them. But Shalom Aleichem can fill theaters for 50 years, 60 years actually now. Not only in New York or in Tel Aviv, but in Tokyo, in Beijing, almost everywhere. And yet, when you hear him reading his stories in Yiddish, and we have just one example, there's nothing can compare with the music. Nothing can compare. When he read, and he read profusely like Dickens, he would go from one place to another, and he killed himself this way. He really destroyed his health by going by trains from one place to another and reading the stories. But it's wonderful. We have the Ich bin Rothschild. Wonderful. And you can hear the music. Thank you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you again for your lecture, for your interpretation, and for the acceptance of our invitation. And I hope to see you again in the museum very soon.
Thank you. I would gladly come.
Thank you for your time.